Welcome to the Dino Animals Podcast. Okay, picture this. Stepping out your front door, say, somewhere in Europe today, and just walking. Walking all the way to North America.
Right. No oceans in the way.
Exactly. Just solid ground under your feet. It sounds completely wild, like science fiction, doesn't it? But millions and millions of years ago, that was actually, well, reality.
It really was.
And it was all possible because of this absolutely immense ancient landmass we call Laurasia. You could think of it as this forgotten northern kingdom, a continent that really shaped the world we live in today.
Yeah, absolutely fundamental.
So today on the Deep Dive, we're going on a kind of time traveling journey. We want to explore Laurasia's incredible story.
Yeah, unpack it a bit.
Our mission really is to get a grip on how it formed this epic geological story and then see what it was like when it was thriving, this huge center of life, and finally track how it dramatically broke apart.
And the consequences of that breakup.
Exactly. We're hoping to uncover some, you know, pretty surprising facts and give you a real shortcut to being genuinely well-informed about how our planet's map came to be and how it keeps changing.
And this isn't just some dusty old history lesson, you know. It's a saga, a geological epic of, like, unbelievable power and constant change. Understanding it will, I think, genuinely change how you look at a map of the world today.
Yeah.
Definitely. We've pulled together information from lots of different places, including our own detailed articles on the Dino Animals website, to really try and bring this ancient world back to life. It shows you just how these massive forces deep inside the earth have been sculpting the surface for, for eons.
Okay, let's dive in then. How did this colossal landmass, Laurasia, actually, how did it come together? It wasn't just poof, there it was.
Oh, right? Absolutely not. It was a very long, slow process.
Yeah.
Think of it like enormous building blocks assembling over geological time. The very beginnings, the sort of ancestors of Laurasia, started coming together over 400 million years ago. That's deep in the Paleozoic era.
400 million? Wow.
Yeah. You had these smaller continents basically smashing into each other. Laurentia, which is, you know, the core of modern North America, collided with Baltica. Northern and Eastern Europe, roughly.
Right.
And also Avalonia, which is another piece. Parts of Western Europe, and even bits of Eastern North America.
So a real mashup.
A huge collision. Geologists call it the Caledonian Orogeny. It was this massive mountain-building event that essentially welded these pieces together into one larger continent. We call that early version Laurussia, or sometimes Euramerica.
Okay, Laurussia. So that's step one. The first big piece of the Laurussia, what came next? Did it just keep growing?
Pretty much, yeah. The next really crucial moment was later. In the late Carboniferous period, this is maybe around 300 million years ago, when the first reptiles were starting to get established.
Right.
This Laurussia continent then collided with another gigantic landmass to its south called Gondwana.
Gondwana, that's the southern supercontinent, right.
Exactly. And that collision, Laurussia hitting Gondwana, that's what formed Pangaea, the biggest supercontinent we think Earth has ever had.
Okay, so Pangaea is formed. Where does Laurasia fit into that?
Well, Laurasia basically became the northern half of Pangaea. It's sort of solidified as a distinct northern region within Pangaea when a couple more large landmasses, Kazakhstania and Siberia, joined that northern block. That happened around 290, 300 million years ago.
I see. So that's when you get that clear split. Laurasia in the north, Gondwana in the south, but all still part of the one massive Pangaea.
Precisely. But then for Laurasia to become the independent supercontinent we're really talking about, Pangaea itself had to start breaking up.
Right, the plot twist.
Kind of, yeah. This started happening much later, around, say, 215 to 175 million years ago. We're the late Triassic now, the early days of the dinosaurs.
Okay.
You had these enormous forces deep within the Earth starting to stretch Pangaea's crust. It thinned, cracked, huge fissures opened up. And eventually, Laurasia physically separated from Gondwana. It ripped apart. And that's when Laurasia became its own thing. A huge, independent continent. Drifting northwards.
So let's connect that to today. If you look at a modern map, which parts of the world were actually part of this Laurasian supercontinent?
Okay, so its footprint is massive. Pretty much all of what we now call North America was part of it.
The whole thing.
Essentially, yes. And most of Europe, too, though maybe not some of the bits right down in the south, they have slightly different, more complex origins.
Okay.
And then a really big chunk of Asia as well. Importantly, though, not India or the Arabian Peninsula. Those guys came from Gondwana much later.
Got it. So North America, most of Europe, Northern and Central Asia, that was Laurasia.
That was the core of it, yeah. The northern foundation of the continents we see today.
Now, with all that land moving around, colliding, splitting apart, the climate must have been drastically different. What was it actually like living on Laurasia back then?
Oh, incredibly varied.
Yeah.
And constantly changing. Back when it was still joined up as part of Pangaea, let's say from about 335 down to 175 million years ago, it saw some really wild climate swings.
Like what?
Well, in the late Carboniferous period, particularly across the areas that are now Eastern North America and Europe, it was incredibly warm and humid, really steamy. Think vast, dense swamps, almost like tropical rainforests.
That was lush.
Incredibly lush. Mm-hmm. And that environment is crucial because that's what created the gigantic coal deposits we still rely on today. Those swamps basically became a prehistoric coal factory.
A coal factory. I like that. So Laurasia was the source of all that coal?
A huge amount of it, yeah. But other parts, like Siberia, which was closer to the pole, would have been much, much colder.
So it wasn't all warm and wet forever?
No.
Definitely not.
The next period, the Permian, saw a really dramatic shift. Things got much cooler globally and, critically, much drier.
Why drier?
Well, Pangaea, including Laurasia, was just so enormous that moist air from the oceans couldn't penetrate far inland. So huge parts of the interior became vast deserts.
Right, like Central Asia today, but on a potentially even bigger scale.
Exactly. And you get extreme seasons, really hot summers, freezing cold winters, and maybe intense monsoon rains in some areas. A much harsher world overall.
Okay, so the climate's changing dramatically. How did plant life, the flora, cope with all this? What did Laurasia's green kingdom look like?
Well, back in those Carboniferous coal factory swamps, the dominant plants were things we don't really see today. Giant tree ferns, huge horsetails called calamites that could be tens of meters tall, and these strange scale trees like Lepidodendron and Sigillaria, very alien-looking forests.
The ones that became the coal.
The very ones. But then, as the climate dried out in the Permian, these swamp-loving plants really struggled.
So what took over?
That's when the gymnosperms really had their moment. These are plants like conifers, cycads, ginkgos, plants with seeds, often with needle-like leaves, much better suited to drier conditions. Things like early conifers, Walkia, for example, and the first ginkgo started to spread and dominate the landscape.
Okay, so gymnosperms take charge. What about later, in the Mesozoic, the Age of Dinosaurs, when Laurasia was its own continent?
Gymnosperms basically rule the plant kingdom throughout the Triassic and Jurassic periods. Laurasia's forests would have been full of different kinds of conifers, palm-like cycads, ginkgos, and another extinct group called Bennettitales.
And these were the main food source for?
For the growing populations of plant-eating dinosaurs, absolutely. They fuel that whole ecosystem.
But then something even bigger happened in the plant world, didn't it? Towards the end, in the Cretaceous period.
Oh, yes. A genuine ecological revolution. This is when angiosperms, flowering plants, first appeared and then diversified incredibly rapidly.
Flowering plants, like flowers.
Exactly. Initially, they were probably quite small, maybe weedy things, but they spread like wildfire across Laurasia. Their ability to reproduce more quickly, to use insects for pollination, to adapt, it completely changed the game. It wasn't just a plant thing. It drove the evolution of insects, changed soils, and set the stage for the kinds of ecosystems we see today.
That's amazing. So with the plants changing, the climate changing, what about the animals? Who were the rulers of Laurasia?
Okay, back in the Paleozoic, in those Carboniferous swamps, you'd find early amphibians, giant insects, and importantly, the very first primitive reptiles. Animals that could lay shelled eggs on land, a huge advantage.
Right, escaping the water.
Exactly. Then, as things got drier in the Permian, reptiles really took over. But the dominant group then wasn't dinosaurs yet, it was the synapsids.
Synapsids?
Yeah, the group that eventually gave rise to mammals, including us. Their Permian descendants, the therapsids, often called mammal-like reptiles, became the top dogs. They had big plant eaters like dicynodonts and fearsome predators like the gorgonopsins. They already had features like specialized teeth, things that would become key mammal traits.
Fascinating. But then came the Mesozoic, Triassic, Jurassic, Cretaceous, the Age of Dinosaurs. Laurasia must have been crawling with them.
Absolutely. It was prime dinosaur territory. And they became incredibly diverse. This is where, actually, the resources we have on dino animals are super helpful. The articles and reconstructions really help you visualize this period.
So using those dino animals materials helps paint the picture. What kind of dinosaurs were distinctive to Laurasia? Were they the same ones you'd find down in Gondwana?
Ah, that's a really important point. They weren't necessarily the same. Laurasia had its own characteristic groups. You'd find the ancestors, or early forms, of the truly giant tyrannosaurs here.
Like T-Rex's family tree started here.
Pretty much, yeah. Also, famous long-necked sauropods like Brachiosaurus and Diplodocus roamed Laurasia, and the duck-billed hadrosaurs were very common, as were early ceratopsians, the horned dinosaurs.
Okay. And how did that compare to Gondwana down south?
There was a definite split. Evolutionary divergence. For example, the top predators in Laurasia during the late Cretaceous were mostly from the Tyrannosauridae family. But in Gondwana, a different group of large predators, the Ablosauridae, evolved to fill that niche.
So like two separate evolutionary experiments running on different continents?
That's a great way to put it. Two massive, isolated laboratories for evolution.
So dinosaurs were clearly the stars. But what else was living there, maybe hiding in the shadows?
Well, crucially, the very first true mammals evolved during this time, likely in Laurasia. They were probably small, maybe shrew-like, probably nocturnal, eating insects, trying to stay out of the way of the dinosaurs.
The underdogs waiting for their chance.
Exactly. And you also had the pterosaurs, those amazing flying reptiles ruling the skies. Plus, lots of different types of crocodile morphs, relatives of crocodiles living in rivers, lakes, and even some adapted to life on land.
Right.
And we shouldn't forget the invertebrates. Insects, spiders, and others were incredibly abundant and diverse. They were vital as pollinators, decomposers, and food for many of the vertebrates. The whole ecosystem was buzzing.
Okay, this is incredible. A vibrant world.
Yeah.
But then it started to break apart. This is where it gets really dramatic, right? What on earth literally could tear a supercontinent like Laurasia apart?
Yeah, the forces involved are just mind-boggling. It really comes down to heat and movement deep within the Earth's mantle, the layer beneath the crust.
Mantle convection.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You can sort of imagine it like an incredibly thick, slow-motion pot of boiling soup under the continents. Hotter rock rises, cooler rock sinks. These massive, slow-moving convection currents drag the tectonic plates on the surface along with them.
Like a giant conveyor belt.
That's a good analogy.
Yeah.
And where these currents pull the crust apart, it stretches, it gets thinner, it cracks. This creates rift zones.
And volcanoes?
Often, yes. As the crust thins, molten rock from the mantle can push its way up, leading to intense volcanic activity along these rift zones. It's this deep engine of heat and movement that literally ripped Laurasia into pieces.
So it wasn't like one sudden snap then. It happened in stages.
Oh, absolutely. A very complex multi-stage breakup over tens of millions of years. Remember, Laurasia had already split from Gondwana back in the late Triassic.
Right.
Then, as a single unit, it started drifting significantly northward. This movement alone had big impacts on climate, moving it farther from the equator.
Okay, so it's drifting north. Then what?
Then the really big split happened internally. The most significant event was the opening of the Atlantic Ocean. This started with initial rifting, probably around 180 million years ago, back in the Jurassic. Little cracks started forming between what's now North America and Europe.
Just small gaps at first.
Yeah, narrow seas. But these gradually widened over millions of years as new ocean floor was created in between. The North Atlantic, as we know it, a really wide ocean, clearly separating the continents, wasn't fully established until much later, maybe around 56 million years ago, in the Paleogene period.
Then we can still see that happening.
We absolutely can. The Mid-Atlantic Ridge, that underwater mountain range running down the middle of the Atlantic, that's the active spreading center where new oceanic crust is still being formed today, pushing North America and Europe further apart centimeter by centimeter.
Wow. Okay, so the Atlantic opens up. What about the other side? How did Europe separate from Asia or North America from Asia?
Well, similar forces were at work further east. The North American plate continued to pull away from the Eurasian plate, and there were complex movements within Eurasia itself. This stretching and shifting eventually led to the formation of the Arctic Ocean basin between them.
So Europe and Asia, while still mostly connected by land today, started defining their modern relationship during Laurasia's breakup, too.
Exactly. The boundaries became much clearer.
If you had to pinpoint the main time frame for all this intense splitting apart, when would that be?
The really intensive phase, the period that truly sculpted the continents we recognize now, was primarily during the Cretaceous period and then into the Paleogene. So roughly from about 66 million years ago down to maybe 30 million years ago, that's when North America finally made its definitive break from Europe, for instance.
Okay, so bringing it all together, what's the big takeaway? How did Laurasia's existence and then its dramatic breakup fundamentally change the planet we live on today? What are the long-term echoes?
The impact was just enormous on almost everything. Think about climate first off. When Laurasia was part of Pangaea, that massive landmass blocked ocean currents from circulating freely.
Right, leading to those extreme inland climates.
Exactly. Huge deserts, big temperature swings.
Right.
But when Laurasia broke up, and importantly, when the Atlantic Ocean opened, it created new pathways for ocean currents.
Ah, allowing heat to move around more easily.
Precisely. Ocean currents could transport heat from the equator towards the poles much more efficiently. This had a huge moderating effect on global climate, made coastal areas more humid, and really helped establish the different climate zones we have today. The breakup literally reshaped the world's weather patterns.
And what about life? We talked about different dinosaurs evolving, but what are the longer-term biological consequences?
Well, the separation of land masses is a primary driver of evolution. When populations get isolated by new oceans or mountains, they start evolving independently. This leads to speciation and the formation of new species.
Like the different predators in Laurasia and Gondwana.
Exactly. But it also explains some really interesting patterns we see today. For instance, have you ever wondered why many plants and animals in North America have their closest relatives way over in East Asia, but maybe not so much in Europe, which seems closer on a modern map?
That is strange when you think about it. Why is that?
The answer lies in the timing of the breakup. After North America split from Europe, a land connection between North America and Asia across the Bering Strait area, what we call Beringia, remained open, or intermittently open, for much, much longer.
Ah, the Bering Land Bridge.
Exactly. That bridge allowed plants and animals to move back and forth between North America and Asia for millions of years, long after the Atlantic had become a major barrier. So they shared species, while Europe became more isolated from North America earlier on. It's a direct legacy of Laurasia's breakup sequence.
That's fascinating. And we actually have hard evidence for Laurasia, right? It's not just a theory anymore.
Oh, absolutely. The evidence is overwhelming now. First, there's the obvious visual clue. The way the coastlines of Africa and South America fit against North America and Europe across the Atlantic, it's like jigsaw puzzle pieces.
A continental fit.
Then there's the geology. You find the same types of rocks and even the same ancient mountain ranges on continents that are now widely separated. The Appalachian Mountains in the eastern U.S., for example, match up perfectly with mountains in Greenland, Scotland, and Norway. The remnants of that Caledonian orogeny we talked about formed when those early pieces of Laurasia collided. The Ural Mountains also mark a collision zone within Laurasia.
So the mountains tell the story.
They do. And perhaps the most compelling evidence initially was the fossils. Finding fossils of the exact same species of land-dwelling reptile or specific type of fern on continents now separated by thousands of miles of ocean. Well, it's pretty hard to explain unless those continents were once joined.
Right. It's that fossil evidence that really helped Alfred Wegener develop his revolutionary theory of continental drift back in the early 20th century. Laurasia was key proof.
It absolutely was. Mm. All these lines of evidence, the fit, the rocks, the fossils, point undeniably to Laurasia's existence and breakup.
So let's bring it right back to you, listening now. Why should you care about a supercontinent from hundreds of millions of years ago? What's the relevance today?
I think the relevance is, well, it's everywhere, really. Understanding Laurasia helps you grasp the sheer dynamism of our planet. It shows that the map is not fixed. It's constantly changing due to these incredibly powerful, deep-seated geological forces.
Yeah, it's not static.
Not at all. And its legacy is tangible. Think about resources the coal formed in those ancient Laurasian swamps might be generating electricity you're using right now. Think about biodiversity. The unique distribution of plants and animals around the Northern Hemisphere is a direct result of Laurasia's history and its fragmentation. It shaped the very stage upon which modern life evolved.
So understanding Laurasia helps us understand, well, pretty much everything about the northern continents and the life on them.
I think so. It shows us Earth as a living, breathing system, constantly reshaping itself over vast timescales.
Laurasia's story is just immense, isn't it? Its formation, its time as this hub of life, and its eventual division fundamentally sculpted the northern half of our world. It set the template for the continents we know, drove evolution in unique directions, and even reshaped the global climate.
Absolutely. It really makes you pause and think, doesn't it? These same tectonic forces are still at work today, constantly moving the plates, building mountains, opening oceans, albeit incredibly slowly from our perspective.
Yeah.
So the provocative thought might be, how will Earth's geography continue to change over the next tens or hundreds of millions of years And what could that mean for the future evolution of life on this planet? It's a continuous story.
A truly mind-bending perspective. A fantastic journey back in time. You can find more information on our Dino Animals website.